again. It's Christopher Bolin. It's Friday afternoon, November 9th. It's 9/11. If 11 being November, the 9th day of November. As I was talking about in the first segment, that the new America, the America of the war on terror, the post 9/11 America, the Jim Garrison quote, that we won't build Dachau's and Auschwitz's. The clever manipulation of the mass media is creating a concentration camp of the mind that promises to be more effective in keeping the populace in line. It's very important because that's what Americans are living in. They, the average American gets his information about the world and current events from watching television or listening to the radio, both of which are corporately owned media. And the big influence in the U.S. media, the 800-pound gorilla, is the Zionist control of U.S. media. And as we said before, as Stephen Waltz said, the U.S. media and U.S. journalists have a one-way street when it comes to talking about Israel. There is no debate about Israeli activities, Israeli policies, or Israel. It's a one-way dialogue. It's a monologue. And that is why the American audience, the average American, has so much difficulty understanding the Middle East, because they are only viewing the Middle East through a very distorted, they have a very warped view of the Middle East. They have the Israeli view in spades. The Israelis live in that reality, and they discuss it much more freely. But the Americans have a Hollywood version of Israel, which is a complete distortion of the reality. So when I talk to people in the United States, like my sister, for example, my sister is a Jewish. She converted to Judaism when she got married, and she has studied Judaism. She's raised her children in the synagogue, and she's active in her temple in Arizona. And but her understanding of the Middle East has come from reading and studying the high school, the college level, and the Hollywood level understanding of Israel.
But it's also very interesting that because she's now Jewish, she has totally severed her relationship with the rest of the family. Mm-hmm. You know, Christopher's brother once told us that, like you and him, you are her previous life, mm-hmm. and now she has this Jewish life, and that has nothing to do with Christians.
Right.
And when our daughter was born, we wanted Karin to be our daughter's godmother. And she initially said, yes, she could do that, but then she talked about it in her synagogue, mm-hmm. and it turned out to be that she couldn't actually do it.
Mm-hmm.
So she could not be her
niece's
godmother.
Right.
And there is no relationship between us, really.
No, but she has absorbed this, Hollywood version of Israel. And, a couple years after 9/11, I was visiting her, and she was familiar with some of my writing, and she said, Christopher, you don't think that Israel had anything to do with 9/11, do you? Or something to that effect. And I don't want to be offensive or anything. I said, well, Israel's not the only one that was involved. There's also indications that there were Americans and British involved and things like that. But what I'm getting at is that for people who have this Hollywood view of Israel being the victim, being the city on a hill, they cannot accept that Israel might do something like terrorism in the United States and hurt American people. That doesn't fit into their worldview. So when the evidence, for example, the evidence of Israeli involvement in 9/11 is presented to them, they reject it. They reject it reflexively. And that's because it's in their worldview, that square peg will not go into the round hole. The square peg being the evidence of Israeli involvement, the round hole being their understanding or their view of Israel. And that's, I think that's something like called cognitive dissonance. It's when the facts do not match your perceptions, so one has to go. And for most Americans who have, you know, been raised on Hollywood films and I suppose Jewish Americans too, it's very difficult to accept that Israel has a history of committing false flag terrorism and attacking the United States and targets Americans, American targets. This is a subject of my second chapter of my Solving 911 series, which I will read the first part of in this broadcast. Because one has to understand that the Israeli state was created by some very dedicated people who had no qualms about breaking the law when it came to providing weapons or material or funds to the state of Israel. In the late 40s, after the war, you know, the United States had this Neutrality Act, and it applied to the conflict in Palestine. So Americans were not allowed to send weapons or to send aid to the conflict to either side. Yet the Haganah under Shimon Peres was raising millions and millions of dollars to buy weapons and to steal weapons in the United States from the post-World War II stockpiles. If you read Zionist history, you know, they brag about how they would steal weapons from U.S. military depots in Hawaii and other places and then smuggle them from California down to Mexico and then put them on planes from Mexico to Palestine. And this went on for years. This was, you know, the FBI was aware of this, and many of these people like Al Schwimmer and Hank Greenspun and Teddy Kollek were wanted by the FBI. And they either went to Israel and lived there or lost their civil rights in the United States. And what the average American doesn't understand is that the creation of the Israeli state, which is now 59 years old, it was created in 1948, was mixed with a great deal of criminality. There was a lot of smuggling going on, and there was a lot of criminal activity that contributed to it. And the people who were involved in this criminal activity, people like Shimon Peres, are still in power. He's the president of the state of Israel today. Shimon Peres is also the father of Israel's nuclear weapons program. He is the person who was the architect. Ben-Gurion put him in charge of procuring weapons for the Haganah back in 1947, I think it was. And he stayed in that office for years and years and years, even after Israel became a state. It was no longer the Haganah. He was then raising weapons for the state of Israel. And Shimon Peres was put in charge of building a nuclear weapons program, which he did. And that nuclear weapons program is today still unlawful and not under the purview of the Atomic Energy Agency in Vienna. So the people who were involved in creating the State of Israel were smuggling weapons to the Haganah in the late 40s. And many Israeli fortunes were made at this time. People like the owner of Carnival Shipping Lines, his name is Arison. Ted Arison was born in Tel Aviv in 1924, and he was put in charge of the Israeli shipping companies that were created after the State of Israel came into existence in the early 50s. And this company was involved in shipping a lot of this war material, this smuggled weapons, from Mexico to Israel. And then he eventually got into the cruise line business and died one of the wealthiest men in the world. But the arms smuggling of the Haganah in pre-state Israel times was done in New York City out of the Copacabana Club off Broadway. And the Copacabana Club was owned by a syndicate, the syndicate, the criminal syndicate of the time. And the people who were involved in providing the weapons were closely tied to Jewish gangsters and people like Bugsy Siegel and Meyer Lansky. And after they smuggled with the weapons that they were smuggling from the United States and other places, they were providing weapons to these Red Army vets who had just finished their war service in Europe. And many of these Red Army vets went to Palestine, hordes of them actually, after the Second World War, and with American weapons provided by American gangsters and other criminals like Shimon Peres, they raised havoc on the Palestinian population and ethnically cleansed much of Palestine. Most Americans don't realize that Israeli terrorism began in the 30s and 40s, and that, you know, some of these people who they hold very dear, like Ben Gurion, supported the bombing of public buildings like the King David Hotel, in which I think something like 100 people were killed. And then this terrorism, after it had been applied to the British, and they killed British soldiers, and they killed the Haganah and the Irgun and the Stern, these Zionist gangs who worked together and sometimes worked, you know, in opposite directions. But they were involved in the murder of Volker Bernadotte, the UN envoy, who was sent to Palestine in 1947 to try and find a just solution or some sort of livable, viable solution to the Palestinian division of Palestine into Jewish sections and Palestinian sections. And he was gunned down in Jerusalem. He and a couple other United Nations people were gunned down by a hit squad. And after the British pulled out in 1947, then the same armed gangs, the Irgun, the Stern, Lehi, and the Haganah, they turned their guns against the Palestinian people. And they ethnically cleansed about 400 towns and villages. For example, Lodi is where the Israeli airport is now. It's called Lod in Hebrew. But Lodi was a large town. And it was ethnically cleansed by Yitzhak Rabin. I think he was involved in that. And 400 villages and towns were ethnically cleansed. And so you want to understand where the Palestinian refugee problem started and where these people all come from and why there are so many Palestinian refugees living in places like Gaza and Lebanon and Syria and Jordan. You have to understand that Palestine was a place where they all lived until 1947, 1948, when they were exposed to brutal Israeli Zionist terrorism. I mean, we're talking about instances when these Zionist gangs would come in to villages and shoot everybody they saw and then dynamite the buildings. And what the situation was, though, is that the Palestinian families were hiding up above on the second floor, but they would dynamite the houses and all the people inside. That was that happened in places like Deir Yassin. But there's many places where that happened. Now, the American people don't know this history, or they have a very sugar-coated version of it. But the Israeli terrorism against the Palestinian people, after they ethnically cleansed Palestine, then they began to look further afield. And the first country that they dealt with terrorism was Iraq and Egypt, these two countries. In Iraq, what the Zionists would do is that they would put terror bombs in Jewish synagogues, because Baghdad and Iraq had a very large Jewish population, and they wanted those Jews from Iraq to go to Palestine, because after they had cleansed the land, so to speak, of Palestinians, and they had put all these Palestinians into refugee camps, or these people were you know, living in tent cities in Gaza and Lebanon, the Israelis wanted to repopulate Palestine with Jewish immigrants, but there weren't that many Jewish immigrants who wanted to come there. So these largely Russian Jews got this idea that if they went to places like Yemen and Iraq and either made deals with the ruling authorities like in Yemen to bring the thousands of Yemenite Jews to Israel, or in the case of Iraq, they had to use terrorism. And so Zionist gangs put bombs in Jewish synagogues in Baghdad in order to coerce the Jewish population to leave. Now that is very important to understand, that Zionists will use terrorism, false flag terrorism, against their own people to get them to move in a certain direction. And in Egypt, they in 1954, the Israelis went on a series of terror bombings, in which they attacked U.S. and British offices. And these bombs were nitroglycerin bombs that were put off in the U.S. Information Services libraries in Alexandria, in Cairo, in British libraries of the same sort, government libraries, in movie theaters, in post offices. And one of the bombers was caught. A bomb went off he was carrying, and he was caught. And then, this was in July 1954, then the entire ring was exposed. Now, this is called the Lavon Affair because the prime minister at the time was a man named Pinchas Lavon. And the blame was put on him. But you see, what they had done is that four Israeli intelligence terrorists had gone to Egypt and they had created what they call sleeper agents. They had found Egyptian Jews who had helped them in the past, with immigration, for example, to Palestine, and they cultivated these people to be sleeper agents. And when they decided to activate this terror campaign against U.S. and British targets, they got these agents to put these bombs in buildings, and their covert plan was discovered. The Egyptians found out about it, and they arrested something like 10 Egyptian Jews. And three of the Israeli agents escaped, and one or two of them committed suicide. Now, this Lavon Affair is very important because this needs to be understood. It's always been a footnote. If you read Middle Eastern history at university level in the United States, for example, you might come across the Lavon Affair very briefly as a footnote. But the understanding what the Lavon Affair was is critical to understanding 9/11, because the people who were involved in the Lavon Affair at the highest level also seem to have had years and years of prior knowledge of 9/11. Most specifically, the head of the Mossad, the first real director of the Mossad, his name is Iser Harel. His real name was Iser Halperin. And in 1942, I think he changed his name to Harel, which means Mountain of God. Mr. Halperin was born in Vitebsk, I think it is, Vitebsk in Belarus today. It's near Lithuania. And he came to Palestine as an 18-year-old, and he joined the Haganah. And in 1944, he was made the chief of intelligence by David Ben-Gurion, who ran the Haganah. Mr. Harel was made the chief of intelligence. And when Israel became a state, Mr. Harel became the head of the Shin Bet, the internal intelligence, the Israeli security agency, if you will. And then subsequently he was made the director of the Mossad. So he was the, not the founder of the Mossad, but he became the first real director. And he served as the head of the Mossad and Israeli intelligence, internal and external, until 1963. So this man had almost two decades as the head of Israeli intelligence in pre-state Israel, and then after Israel was created in 1948. Now, after this break, I'm going to take a break. I'm going to talk about how Iser Harel had uncanny knowledge about the attacks of September 11th. In 1980. So stay tuned. You'll find this to be very interesting. And worthwhile. So thank you. Stay tuned. This is Christopher Boland.